What's going on, friends? Welcome back to Bitcoin Builders. Today, we're trying something a little different. I've always thought that one of the most unique and buildable assets on Bitcoin is its on-chain data. Today, I'm joined by Glassnode's James Check, Checkmate on Twitter, to look at what Bitcoin on-chain data is telling us about where we are in the larger cycle. James is incredibly good at explaining what the data is telling us, and I think you're going to love this one. Bitcoin Builders is a show about Bitcoin optimism, energy, and entrepreneurship. It's brought to you exclusively by In Wolf's Clothing, Wolf, the first startup accelerator focused on Lightning. Today is April 11th. This is Bitcoin Builders. Let's go. All right, James, welcome to Bitcoin Builders. How are you doing, sir?
Thanks, Matt. It's great to be here. Looking forward to it.
I'm super excited for this. You know, you and I have been talking a little bit, and this is something that I've wanted to do for a long time on the regular breakdown. And then, you know, shifting over into sort of doing some of this additional Bitcoin stuff with Bitcoin Builders, I thought it was the perfect time to really get into this. And I guess, you know, we're going to go through sort of a bunch of the stories that on-chain data is telling us right now about where we are in the cycle in terms of how different holder cohorts have shifted over the last few months, and how much of this sort of recent rally is spot versus derivatives driven. But I think more broadly, just sort of starting off this conversation, you know, the reason that I've always been fascinated with on-chain data is that we operate in an environment where the voices of people who want to have voice are extremely loud, right? People who are willing to kind of get involved and into the fray in the conversation on Twitter can make their voices known. And I love that about Bitcoin. I think it's great. And I think it's sort of permeating into lots of different aspects of the discourse. But the one challenge of that is that it often sort of leaves out the voices of, you know, more passive people or just sort of people who don't want to get in debates all the time. And I think that what on-chain data has always represented to me is sort of like this unimpeachable, you know, collective voice of Bitcoiners showing what they're actually thinking through their behaviors, you know, and I think that's a really cool thing. But, you know, I want to start, I guess, just with a little bit of background for you, like how you came to start dabbling with sort of this sort of on-chain data and how it got you hooked.
Yeah, absolutely. It's and I agree with you. We were talking about this the other day, how on-chain data is kind of the silent majority, right?
Yeah.
And the thing I like about on-chain data is that it's just factual. It's just what happened on the chain. And like all data, it takes a process of actually cleaning it, filtering it, and then finding what the signal is. But what you don't see is all the people shouting and yelling on Twitter. What you see are people who deliberately chose to sign with their private key to send coins, to apply hash to the network. And the interesting thing about on-chain data is that it's unforgeably costly, right? You must spend a transaction fee. You must burn energy. In order to make an imprint on the Bitcoin ledger, you have to actually exert some kind of scarce resource. So that's kind of the bones of it. Where I came from, so my background is civil engineering. I used to actually design tunnels and holes and basements, foundations, things like that. What we deal with a lot in that is uncertainty and risk, because when you're designing a tunnel, you don't know what's under the ground unless you drill a hole there. And once you've drilled a hole there, the ground's not there anymore. So you have to interpolate between bore holes and try and identify how did the rock get there in the first place? What's kind of the mental model and structure of it? So what you're dealing with is a lot of uncertainty, a lot of probabilities, and a lot of interpolation, right? I've got these two data points. How do I fill in the blanks so that we don't run into something hairy? And through 2018, I found kind of Bitcoin in these markets. And it wasn't until late 2018 when it finally clicked to me that what Bitcoin really, like the promise that it really held in a macro standpoint. So what on-chain data was really growing up at that point in time. Some of the early metrics, Coinmetrics released the realized cap, which is kind of the on-chain market cap, so to speak, valuing every coin at the price when it last moved. And that really ushered in a wave of innovation, new ideas, new cycle metrics, things to start really tracking the heartbeat of what Bitcoin is doing. And it really triggered my fascination. I've kind of glued the markets side of my interest to, hang on a second, you're telling me I can actually watch how this thing behaves on the network itself? And I've tried to use many different mechanisms to explain what on-chain data is. I think probably the most accurate is its economics. It's the same way that we would look at CPI or GDP data for the traditional economy. Here we're looking at the flow of funds, the sentiment, the profit, the loss, the holding time, We're basically looking at who is spending, who is holding, and why. And you can obviously draw inferences from that, but it's not just economics, it's also behavioral economics. And because Bitcoin is such a volatile but also ideological asset, you get these very consistent patterns play out. The way that the hodlers behave at late-stage bear markets is very consistent. The way that sellers get mobilized on a 75% drawdown is very, very consistent. So, I even went into the 2022 bear cycle expecting, some of these models are going to break, some of these concepts will break, and of course, some of them do. But for the most part, the human behavioral side of things doesn't change, right? The Fed changes, the asset changes, the prices change, but the ape brain does not. We all do the same thing in response to fear and greed. And that's really what I found the most alpha in on-chain analytics, is understanding kind of the heartbeat of what Bitcoin's doing, understanding the mechanics of how the investors and the behaviors take place, and those same human reactions that we all feel, right? When things go up, you have a certain particular feeling. When you're more experienced and you've survived a couple of cycles, your response to a rally from 15K to 30K is different to a guy who bought the top and is seeing the first probably upside that he's ever seen. So these dynamics play out over time, and they're essentially recorded forever on the network. So we can extract that data and turn it into some very, very interesting insights.
So a couple of things that I think are super interesting about what you said. One is the idea, which I think is not intuitive unless you've spent some time in and around Bitcoin, that these metrics are basically waiting to be discovered. And a lot of them are people looking at two different things compared to one another that others haven't quite put together. And that sort of becomes a new metric that people actually find really useful. Why I say this isn't intuitive is that I do think it really took some of those sort of early innovations, let's call them, in how people were looking at them to really click in and to have people understand that, hey, this is actually a set of data that I can go parse in different ways. And it's still evolving, right? I feel like once every few months, I see a Glassnode report where you guys introduce sort of a new metric, which is really just a new way of looking at the same data, right? So I think that's something that's super interesting. And I do think that's also one benefit of bear markets, right? It's not surprising to me that a lot of that happened in 2018, 2019, as people had a little bit more time to sit around and squint. I guess the other piece that I kind of wanted to reference is we talk about so many of the innovations with Bitcoin. The fact that all of this information is perfectly available is something that almost gets shunted down the tier list of incredible innovations, but it becomes very hard to go back to sort of other assets once you have this side of level of on-chain data and sort of perfect, if not explanatory power, at least the ability to understand what actually happened. Have you found that, just looking at kind of, across what data is available to you in other types of markets?
Yeah, no, I'll touch on both of those points. So the first one is we are always exploring and still finding things. And we kind of break down, at least internally, there's kind of things we would call primitives. So these are things, realized cap, for example, is a primitive. It's something that it's a unique and it's not just a ratio, right? I haven't just divided put and call volume or, active addresses by volume. It's kind of that root. What is the base level of data, right? Realized cap is how many people realize profits, right? If you bought a coin at 10K and sold it at 20K, then there's a realized profit and likewise on the other side for a loss. So these things are kind of the primitives. And there's fewer of those, but you're absolutely right. They're kind of out there to discover. What we then do is kind of pass, filter, and that goes on two different levels, right? At one point, there's actually taking the data and saying, well, that's all Binance. Let's filter out Binance's behavior. Let's only look at people who have held their coins for more than 1 year. So it's kind of the filtering process. And then there's the analysis side, which is actually taking that filtered information and turning it into an insight, turning it into something that's actually useful. So yes, we are constantly discovering new things. And in terms of the kind of relative data sets, so my experience definitely is heavily Bitcoin oriented. That was a conscious decision, because what I found is that the level of, I guess, how organic and consistent Bitcoin's data set was and is, just gave it so much signal. Now, if you transfer that same logic, you can't take the same metric and necessarily apply a Bitcoin-like metric to Ethereum. And the reason being, because coins move in a different way, right? For Bitcoin, because it's primarily a monetary asset, and really only until this year did we see anything like ordinals and inscriptions that kind of creates a new type of demand for block space. Historically, it's been coins moving from A to B, right? Whether a buyer or seller, someone consolidating coins in their wallet, Binance, moving coins around, whatever it is, these things have typically been monetary transfers. Now, once you move into the world of Ethereum and all the other chains, you do have it's a whole different ecosystem, right? If a holder moves his coins into a liquidity pool, is that him disposing of it? When he withdraws, he may well get different volumes of coins out, but which part did he dispose? Is he actually hodling it? What does he do if he's borrowing from a money market and then creating a position? It's a lot more of a dynamic economy. So the same kind of vanilla metrics don't necessarily apply. It takes a lot more filtering and a lot more processing, but also it creates a degree of noise. And not in the sense that it's a negative thing, it's purely just for Bitcoin, you are seeing the same set of data by a set of people who are responding to an asset who is, you know, what do they call it? Boomer coin, right? All it does is move UTXOs around the network. So the fact that it's so simple and yet it contains so much signal and information is kind of the part that fascinated me. It was like, this thing is so rich. And yet every mainstream headline you look at is telling me that it's a waste of time. It doesn't do anything. It's like, well, there's a lot of people who disagree with that notion and I can see them moving around every single day.
Well, that signal is the perfect jumping off point for some of the specifics that we wanted to get into tonight. So one of the things that we've been talking about a lot is something that it seems like you've been observing, which is the way that things shifted around the sort of inflection point moment of FTX. Obviously, everyone who lived through that, who was in the crypto industry, knew that it was significant. Obviously, it's been politically significant, among other implications. But the on-chain story is also significant. And so I want to dig into a little bit sort of, you know, what we've started to see sort of following FTX and what it suggests about where we are in the overall cycle.
Totally. And I think this kind of gets into the crux of what creates kind of Bitcoin floors. And, you know, not knock on wood that we've got a Bitcoin floor behind us. You know, it kind of remains to be seen, but let's just take that as a given for now. So, you know, when we're looking at on-chain data, we tend to use cohorts, what we call cohorts. And one of the more popular ones that that Glassnode came up with back, I think it was 2020, was this concept of long and short-term holders. So what we're doing here is we're dividing because we can see when a coin was acquired, and that means we can see the price when it was acquired and how long the investor has held it. Now, if you look at a probability distribution of how often coins are spent, basically the longer that a coin remains in someone's wallet, the more likely it is to stay there. So the other way to think about that is hodlers be hodling. And people who are kind of buying and selling, what we call the short-term holders, these coins represent like 75 to 90% of on-chain volume at any one day. So there's kind of the day-to-day trade that's churning and churning and churning. And then there's the coins that kind of pass this age threshold, which is about 5 months, 155 days. A few other analysts have tested this. It's all within that kind of range, four, five, 6 months. Once it gets beyond that level, you have what we call long-term holders. And these are the least probable coins to spend. And it's a really nice way to just kind of look at the hodlers versus the day-to-day trade. Now, market cycles, when it's trading higher, what we see is that these longer-term holders distribute their coins. Typically, as we break all-time high, they start spending, and you get this kind of influx of old money selling and smart money leaving the building, and they're transferring their wealth to the guy who just saw Bitcoin on the news, or his mate said, hey, look, I'm getting rich off this thing. You should come and buy some. This was me back in 2018 buying the exact top. So basically, you get this oversaturation with short-term holders, inexperienced investors, so on and so forth. Now, over the course of the bear market, and by the way, the chart that we're looking at here is what we call the realized price. This is the average price of every coin that's been moved, broken into those cohorts. In orange, we've got the all market, right? So every single investor, what is their current cost basis? We've got in the blue, which is those longer-term holders. People have held their coins for 5 months or so. And then in the red, which you can see tends to follow price much more closely, this one here is our short-term holders. That's kind of the day-to-day trade. Now, what you'll notice is that during the bull market, right, we've got 2017 here as an example, and during the bull market in 2021, notice how they all separate. The logic here is you've got the short-term holders are kind of chasing price. These are the coins that are kind of following price. It's being revalued alongside the market. In the blue, where you've got your long-term holders, these are people who bought in the previous bear cycle. So they've essentially got a very, very low cost basis, and it only starts to climb once coins reach that age boundary. So during bull markets, they diverge because the long-term holders are actually exiting their position. They've got a lower cost basis. They're lessening their load. Short-term holders are effectively buying the top. Now, what you'll also notice is that during bear markets, note how they all actually coalesce and reach, they kind of all form a very, very similar level in and around price shown by these purple zones. That's really reflecting a couple of things. So during the course of the bear market, there's guys who bought the top, right? They've got $60,000 Bitcoin, price goes to 40, like, don't worry, it'll come back. price goes to 30. I swear it's going to come back. Gets to 20. They go, I'm getting close. Finally, you get that capitulation event, that point in time when you get this just complete purging of wallets. So what I was saying before, long-term holders, we typically talk about hodlers. Short-term is typically traders. There's one point in time where that is actually the exact opposite. It's flipped around. And the reason is because whenever a coin is sold in on-chain analytics, we basically see a coin go from somebody's wallet to an exchange, and then some other coin will come out when somebody else buys that. So when the coin comes out, we deem it to be a short-term holder, right? It's a recently moved coin. It's fairly young. It's only recently transacted. And typically at the late stage bear market, it's the people who bought the top and they've passed that 155. They've been telling themselves, no, this thing's coming back for 155 days or 5 months, 6 months, 8 months. And they finally just puke. So what you end up having there at these bear market floors is you've essentially reached a point of seller exhaustion where everybody has just got so much red in their portfolio, they can't deal with it anymore, and they just get flushed. So who's on the other side of that trade? Well, these are the people who have the very, very highest conviction, where they understand why Bitcoin's here. They've got that long-term view. They're willing to step in when FTX blows up and the narrative is that Bitcoin's dead for 10 years. You kind of get this flushing out of coins from the long-term holders, which are actually top buyers, and transferring to those really hardcore folks who are willing to step in front of a train at the bottom. And what's interesting, that this kind of congregation of these cost bases shows that the market is now homogenous. It doesn't matter whether you've been here for 5 months, 6 months, 2 years, 5 years. On average, everybody's got a very, very similar cost basis. We've essentially returned to a state of hodlers. Is it only the hodlers that remain? So I think the key important point here is bear market floors are both a point of seller exhaustion, where you flushed out the final seller, the guy who's been hanging onto that coin for so long, believing it's coming back, and he finally just takes the purge. But you also have a changing of hands. There's a new set of buyers with a much, much lower cost basis. And I think we'd all agree, if you're holding coins you bought at 16,000, it's a hell of a lot easier to do that than a coin that was at 60,000. So now that the market starts to respond, all of those investors are now back in profit. So essentially, they've been rewarded for stepping in front of the train and taking that risk. But it's kind of this interesting dynamic where the holder base changes. It's not necessarily about where the coins are and which wallet they're in. It's about the fact that they changed and now their cost basis is much, much lower and much, much more favorable.
And now a quick word from our sponsor. Today's podcast is brought to you by In Wolf's Clothing. Wolf is the first startup accelerator dedicated to Lightning. 4 times per year, Wolf brings teams from around the world to New York City to work with like-minded entrepreneurs, pushing the boundaries of what's possible with Bitcoin and Lightning. The program is designed to help early-stage startups achieve product-market fit, develop their brand, secure early-stage funding, and grow businesses that fuel the global adoption of Bitcoin. Learn more or apply at wolfnyc.com. That's wolfnyc.com. And now, back to the show. It sounds like another way to put it is there's a reset event that always happens at which everything compresses to the similar spot. And I feel like in some ways, this is an area where the words that we use break down a little bit, because long-term holder, we have this sort of envision of someone who's kept it, you know, forever, right? It has got, you know, is never going to sell, but we're talking about a technical definition. And effectively, this is the point at which the short-termers have become long-termers by no conviction of their own necessarily, just sort of desperately hoping that things change. And this is the point at which they no longer can play the long-term holder game. And so a different set of potentially long-term holders comes in to become the short-term holders. So they almost just sort of reverse who they are.
And the other way to think about it is it's basically, it's all about holding time. So think about short-term holders as people who recently acquired their coins. That's the correct way to think about it, because at the bull market top, if you recently acquired your coin, if the price drops like it did in May 2021 by 50%, suddenly you're underwater by 50%. So your behavioral model is now going to respond to that event. If, on the other hand, you're stepping in front of the FTX train and buying it when Bitcoin's dead for another 10 years, right? And the industry's going to zero, you've recently acquired your coin, you've got some real stones to have done that. So you're looking at people who stepped in front and you know, we're still here after the pretty dramatic bear market that 2022 was.
I actually think that's a really valuable linguistic shift to think about, sort of, you know, recency of acquisition versus duration of holding. I mean, it's the same thing, you know, functionally, but in terms of people imagining, it's sort of, you know, when did you get in has a deterministic sort of impact on where you fit in the market. Okay, so we have this sort of price compression period, right? This is what this purple band represents here between kind of July 22, which is obviously just after Luna, and I think 3AC is happening then, to January of this year, which is, you know, just as sort of coming out of the haze of the FTX collapse.
And the thing we're highlighting here with this purple is that you can see that price is actually trading below those levels. So what that's indicating is that the average investor within those cohorts is underwater on their position. I think it's a nice segue into this guy here. You know, what actually precipitates the bear market floor, right? What creates that final sell side? So what this chart is looking at, a lot of people who've been looking at Glassnode or on-chain analytics, you'll actually recognize that purple chart. It's what we call NUPL, which is net unrealized profit and loss. So if we look at the whole coin supply, how much profit, right? If you acquired your coin in the previous bear at like 8K, and we're currently sitting here at 30K, right? You're holding, what is that, $22,000 profit, right? Times your coin volume. So what this is doing is it's looking at, let's look at the whole coin supply. What percentage is in profit and what percentage is in loss? And what you'll see is that the floors that we tend to hit, these kind of lower levels that FTX reached, you'll see that the red is all fairly horizontal, right? We kind of hit that same level cycle after cycle. So the way to think about this, there's only so much financial pain that investors can take. They kind of sit there, and as I said before, they'll look at the red and they'll get worse and worse and worse. And then eventually they go, I cannot take this anymore. I'm done. I'm selling this thing. I hate it. It's over. So this is kind of representing that psychological level that creates sellers. What is the amount of loss that needs to be carried by the market before we finally motivate that final capitulation, right? How much stress and financial pain does the market need to carry before we actually see that flush out? So this is looking at it from the perspective of the unrealized profit and loss, right? How much is held within the coin supply that hasn't been spent? There's a whole other layer to this, which is then the realized component. So yes, we can see there's a bunch of people holding underwater coins. But like we were saying before, at the bottom of a bear market, there's a lot of people. I mean, I myself, I've got coins I acquired at like 50K, right? So they're underwater, but I don't particularly care because I've got other coins that aren't at 50K, right? They're at a much more favorable cost basis. So there's some portion of like damage that the market can carry, and hodlers in particular, who are fairly price insensitive, they will be willing to carry that level. But there's a lot of portion of the market that will eventually flush out. So we can combine this particular metric with the realized component, which is, did they actually spend? Did you actually see people who bought coins at 50,000 flushing them out at 16 or 18 or whatever it is? And the answer is we did, but you kind of glue these things together. Who is still here and what's the damage they're holding? And then who actually exited the market and how much did they lock in? So you can't kind of put those two pieces together and you get a really interesting picture of the market.
It's fascinating. And so what was that telling us sort of in this early period from this year?
Yeah, so my big takeaway, there's a couple of things. So one, you can see obviously that horizontal level. So we hit that level which has historically created sellers. It has been sufficient red in the portfolio to motivate that capitulation. The other thing you'll note, and you'll see this in all of these previous market cycles, in 2018, you can see that we got this really price climbed to from 3K to 4K, but you can see that this blue curve here really had quite a steep trajectory higher, and we have much the same at the moment, right? A very, very steep trajectory higher on our on the blue curve, which is the net level. What that's telling you is a bunch of coins went from loss to profit. So the other way to think about that, well, I mean, how can that possibly happen? If in 2018, price only went from 3K to 4K. Percentage-wise, it's significant. But in terms of dollar value, it's not that significant considering it came from 20 down to 3. What you're seeing there is there's a bunch of coins that capitulated out, and they were actually that transferring of hands. So all you need is price to go 1 cent above their buy level, and now they're in profit. It goes $1, $5, $10. So suddenly you have a rally like we've just had that goes from 16K up to 30K, all those coins have now returned to profit. So what you're actually looking at is kind of a supplier concentration that was built up below us, and they've all now returned to a profitable level. So you've kind of got this, you can see that changing of the hands. They're now all back in the green. They've got a much more favorable cost basis. You look at that and it's like, it's actually a much healthier market. And at kind of the biggest level, it's very much like commodities. You'll see commodities come back down towards their cost of production. you'll get this kind of capitulation, CapEx goes to zero. People go, oh, I can't invest in gold, it's a dead asset. But then those steady buyers just come in and set that floor, low cost basis, and next thing you know, there's just no supply left on the market. And you see this kind of very vertical move, and that's that rapid return to profit that tells you what actually happened below us.
Okay, so we're starting to get a very clear picture of all of this happening sort of at the same time. What does this suggest to you in terms of phase of the cycle that we're in? What does it suggest in terms of, you know, historical precedent about where we are relative to kind of the longer market cycle?
I've been talking about this recently, actually. Where we are and kind of that 25 to, let's say, 28 range, that to me, when I kind of look at that from several angles, it kind of was the end of the deep value zone. So when we look at many, many metrics, and we'll explore these in a second, when we got down to even the 3 hours event, when it took us down in June, I think we got down to 17.6 or something, and then we oscillated around 20,000, 18,000. That zone was kind of the start of what we would consider to be a bottom formation period. We did have the capitulation. We had the amount of unrealized loss in the system, and many, many oscillators really hit that kind of low point, saying that the market's underwater, people are flushed out, the amount of supply that's held by these hodlers is still continuing to grow, so people are buying and just taking coins off exchange and putting them in their wallet. So by many things, we'd kind of hit that very, very deep value zone. As we get up above that 25 to 28 zone, and you'll see in several of these metrics here, we're starting to come off the bottom. This one here is looking at the amount of... think about this like hodling opportunity cost. We could make a choice to spend our coin right now, but if we choose not to, this metric's going to go lower. If we start spending and flushing out that holding time, this metric's going to trend higher. And you can see we've started to recover back out of this low point. Same here for this one here is also looking at the amount of holding time that's been flushed, or the dollar value of holding time. You can see that we're really starting to push up. And this one here is kind of, if you were just to eyeball it, somewhere in the middle of this range. And that's the right way to think about it. We're kind of in this point where we've seen the deep value correction. And by many metrics, whether it's the amount of holders that are starting to distribute, whether it's the amount of dollars that are coming into the system, the amount of holding time that's being flushed out, all of these things are describing somewhat of a reversion to the mean. So where we currently sit at about 30,000, and actually another technique that I'll often do with these is just look at how many days have we been above or below this level. And for most of these metrics, we're pretty much at neutral, meaning 50% of days we've been above, 50% of days we've been below, right? Plus or minus a couple of percentage points. So what we're looking at here is we're kind of in like a nebulous middle region. There's not really a deep value. I often talked about like a slingshot. When you pull the slingshot too far away from mean reversion, at some point it's going to want to snap back. We've kind of done that initial snap. And now we're in this reaccumulation type period. We're kind of in the middle of everything. We're not heavily overheated. We're not heavily undervalued. It's kind of in this nebulous zone of somewhat price discovery in that regard. We kind of have to work our way through people who bought the bottom want to sell, people who are still holding coins from the top and want to sell, narratives start to shift, what is Bitcoin going to be in 5 years' time? All these things tend to start to evolve and people kind of justify the ups and the downs, but we've kind of left that deep value zone by most of my models.
It's super interesting to hear that from kind of the model perspective, because I think that there is a very proximate feeling looking at it from the standpoint of narrative, in the sense that you do not have the mass emergence of some new narrative that is driving new people to market. What you have is sort of reclaimed narratives and recently sort of restored to glory narratives, long-term narratives of Bitcoin that are regaining traction with observers, but never necessarily left favor with the people who stuck around. And so obviously you're kind of seeing on the one hand, mainstream media articles about, hey, you know, Bitcoin's performing pretty well in the context of bank crisis. And what was that inscribed on the first Genesis, you know, on the Genesis block? But it hasn't driven a whole set, or it hasn't felt like it's driven a whole new set of people in, right? Bitcoiners aren't getting calls from their normie friends asking how they get in necessarily. And it does feel this sort of in-between period where there is clearly a sort of back to the worst kind of feeling, although I think everyone's a little trepidatious of being sure that that's the case. You talked about price discovery. There's also a narrative discovery and what Bitcoin's story going into the next halving is, and you know, to what extent it's sort of this, you know, how different it is. And I think part of also complicating this is that there are competitors. On the one hand, you have this sort of big blaring thing you know, its contrast to the counterparty risk of banks that I think is really loud for a lot of folks, even people who aren't necessarily sort of lining up to buy more Bitcoin yet. But then you also have all these new things, right? You have this mass explosion of people actually building on Bitcoin. You have ordinals, which is, you know, create, you know, have these new creative excitement around it. And so it really is a narrative discovery phase on top of a sort of price discovery phase. So like I said, kind of just interesting to see these things moving in parallel.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the thing that I often find about, and I think we alluded to this at the start, is that you get to see, you know, people often say, but hang on a second, you're not accounting for all these macro forces, but what happens if Jay Powell says this thing? And the way that I look at this is like, okay, that's fine. But if I look at myself back in 2019, I was accumulating Bitcoin because I saw this debt problem and all the kind of the main macro reasons that that Bitcoin kind of carries at the moment. I was expressing my view about those macro future events by accumulating Bitcoin. So my behavior pattern was actually showing up in the data, right? That very, very small footprint that I left is essentially my decision to respond to what the Fed and what macro markets and all that were going to do. So in many ways, what we're looking at with on-chain data is how did the investor, okay, that's fine. Narrative shift, Jay Powell's opinion shifts, right? The market moves around, but how do people respond by expressing their opinion via Bitcoin? So it's kind of one of those interesting dynamics. And just kind of bring it back to what you mentioned before about where are we in the cycle? This is a neat little tool that that we developed at the start of the year. And the concept here is that there's lots of these different decisions people make. So what we've done is take four different categories of data that we look at with on-chain analytics. And green, we're looking at prices. Is price trading above key levels, realized price, 200-day moving average? On the yellow, we're looking at, do we have increasing network adoption? Do we actually have people moving coins? Are people transferring value? Are fees starting to build? Are we actually seeing usage of the Bitcoin network itself? In the blue, we've got what we call profitability, because you know, in a bull market, people take profits, right? That's what you want to see. It's kind of this ironic thing that lots of people will say, but hang on a second, this metric goes up in a bull. I was like, yes, that's people selling to you. So it's one of these things, but at the same time, you still need there's no profits in a bear. That's kind of the typical behavior. So is the market actually locking in some kind of profit? And then we've got another one, which is the pink or the red color, which is mapping out, do we have a concentration of wealth held by the smart money? And are those coins actually going back into the green, right? Coming from that bear market floor, we have that capitulation event and coming back into the green. So what this thing is trying to do is take 8 metrics, 2 in each of those buckets, and structure out and say, do we actually have a robust and resilient recovery typical to what we see in previous bear market cycles? And as you can see, we've got kind of got this blue, this light blue color, which is when 5 of the 8 are firing, and the purple color is when all 8 are firing off. And you can see we've essentially, for a couple of weeks now, had all of these firing off. So what that really means is we've kind of left that deep value zone, right? Where, you know, essentially everything is bearish at the most bearish point, which is the bear market floor. Right, that's when you typically see maximum bearishness, and all of these metrics were no different. We do have another version of these that tracks that kind of cycle extreme, top and bottom. But what we can see here is we've done that recovery. We do in fact have these signals firing on the right-hand side here. So we do have the market taking profits, which is good because someone's got to come in with more capital. It means there's a demand inflow. The network is growing. There's more people using it. Ordinals are firing off. There's more addresses. There's more adoption. We're above those key pricing levels. And we kind of hit that saturation of hodlers, which are now starting to come back into the green. So it's one of these nice ways we can kind of glue these concepts together and say, you know, across these separate concepts within the on-chain world, do we actually have signal fire across all of them?
Yeah, it's pretty interesting because obviously, you know, if you saw one running in the other direction, that would probably lead you down a path of asking, well, what is it about that particular thing that, you know, might be lagging behind or telling a different story? You know, is it lagging or is it leading, right?
Yeah, exactly. And you know, a great example of this is a concept that I refer to as payload. So when you're looking at what I call on-chain activity metrics, things like active addresses, transaction counts, things like that, you may have an all-time high in the number of transactions. And people might say, oh, that's fantastic. Great. Look, the network's highly adopted. But what if that's just an exchange consolidating, you know, $10 UTXOs, right? And it's not really meaningful volume. So when you introduce the concept of payload, which is it actually moving a lot of value? Because when you have an all-time high in transactions, but an all-time low in transaction volume, that colors you, you know, it's good, but it's not great. If you see an all-time high in both of those things, that's fantastic, right? That shows there's lots of settlement volume and you've got transactions happening. So both of these things are telling you a lot about it. So it is a bit of a puzzle and it is a bit of a process to kind of learn which tools kind of answer the question. But, you know, at the end of the day, bringing back to that original point we had, it's about economics. What do you want to see? And often the most intuitive answers are the right ones. In a bull market, I want to see people in profit and I want to see them taking profit and the market continuing to push through it. So if you have supply and profit going up, if you have the amount of profits being taken going up, and you have price still going up, all of these things are a good sign. At some point in time, yes, that's going to reach an oversupply. But you don't see all of those things in bear markets, right? You don't see people getting more in profit as price goes down by 75%. Are more people adopting the network? If yes, across several metrics, it's probably a good sign. So these are some of these kind of fairly simple rudimentary concepts, but it just comes down to the application side, which is, you know, how do we actually take this information and convert it into an insight that's actually useful for me in the market?
On the lines of squinting at this particular return over the course of 2023, I know this is something you've been spending a lot of time looking at. How much or what have you been able to glean about what's actually driving this price action, as opposed to, you know, what's driven rallies in the past?
Yeah, absolutely. So this is a really interesting topic, and there's kind of two angles here, right? And I often refer to them as the dog and the tail. So the dog is essentially the spot market, the on-chain market, and the tail is derivatives. If you move across to the traditional finance world, the derivatives market is they're larger than spot in this market too, but we're talking about an order of magnitude larger. So if you look at the S&P 500, right, the S&P minis are essentially the primary trading vehicle. There's so much more volume and open interest that exists in those derivative products. This market is getting there, but typically speaking, the dog wags the tail. You'll see that most of our perpetual swap markets, the indexes will follow spot. Of course, there's an incentive for traders to go into spot markets and move around the index to move their futures positions. So they are connected, and this is why they respond similarly. But what 2022 really represented was just an unbelievable deleveraging. Not only did we see futures and options and all the trade volumes, the open interest got wiped out, liquidations all the way down, we saw venues like FTX get wiped out, right? So there's actual places where a lot of this leverage existed that doesn't exist anymore. There was many actors, right? The Celsius of the world and these entities who had just huge loans that existed both in the off-chain derivative space, but also in the DeFi sector. So what we really saw through 2022 was an enormous deleveraging. Now, meanwhile, there's been this kind of behavioral shift. Well, I mean, it's always present, but in the spot market, we did see continued accumulation going on by many wallet cohorts. So we actually released a report on this recently, but this particular chart that we're looking at, it's something that we call the yearly absorption rate. So when we're looking at coins across the supply, we'll break it down into cohorts, right? We talk about shrimp, people who have less than one BTC, crabs, 1 to 10, fish, shark, so on and so forth, and then whales with more than 1,000. So within the, you know, for argument's sake, the 19.3 million Bitcoin, there's going to be some volume of them on exchanges, some volume held by whales, some of them in GBTC, and some of them held by shrimp. What this yearly absorption rate is doing is saying, okay, well, how do we normalize and just look at who's growing their dominance and who's shrinking it? And a really nice way to do that is just compare it to the amount of coins that were mined over the last year. So Bitcoin is consistently being mined at the moment, 900 per day. Okay, 900 per day. I mean, we can measure the actual value, but times 365 days. How much of that did shrimp absorb? Did crabs absorb? Did whales absorb? So what we're seeing here is shrimp, crabs, and fish. So everybody who's got under 100 Bitcoin. And these are, I mean, rocketing to new all-time highs. So what we're seeing here, these are above 100%, by the way. So shrimp and crabs and fish, they essentially accumulated a volume equivalent to more than the total coins mined over the last year. So every coin that was mined went to shrimp. We've then got another version, another amount that's equivalent to the coins that were mined that went to crabs, about 75% to fish. And you can say, well, okay, we're in a fixed supply system with Bitcoin. Where did those coins come from? And the answer to that is that they actually flowed out of our whales and our exchanges. So we saw that whales and exchanges have actually been net distributors. The amount of coins held by the whale cohort here in purple declined to about negative 85%. So they distributed an additional sell side. You've got your mining, coins coming in, they added an extra 85% to that. And then the rest of the coins actually flowed out of exchanges, right? So exchanges have seen enormous outflows, 172%. So you've got all the coins that were mined, then you've got 85% additional sell side by whales and another 175% by exchanges. They've essentially transferred those coins across to shrimp, fish, crabs, and even up to the shark cohorts. So basically everybody who's a smallish type holder up to institutional size capital, right, up to 1,000 Bitcoin, these entities have grown their share. So when we kind of put the whole story we've looked at today, we've got a capitulation event that occurred in the spot market. We've seen FTX, which is typically like the event that puts the nail in the coffin. You've got a transferring of coins from larger holders and exchanges back towards kind of the more retail, but up to institutional size capital, kind of back to that grassroots Bitcoin, you know, coming up from the smallest holders. And you also have the reduction of leverage. So that's kind of the spot regime. When we look at the market, we tend to break it into two. We've got what's going on in the spot market. When you move across to the derivative space, so here we're looking at the perpetual swap market. Let me put this onto the all view. This is for Bitcoin and Ethereum. Open interest, you can see that, you know, we're up, but we're nowhere near where we were during bull market levels. The overall open interest that's in the market, this is it priced in BTC and ETH, which kind of removes the, if you've got a one BTC position, it's going to move with spot price. So if we take that out and just look at how much has open interest grown, you can see that FTX blowing up, or just before it, was the all-time high in leverage. Now, a bunch of this fell out because FTX literally ceased to exist, so all that open interest went to zero. But you can actually see there's been a massive net decline, which has been going on for 8 months now, of net open interest decline. So we are seeing there's actually less leverage in the system. There's a lot less actors in the system. So when you kind of put all this picture together, what I see is a market that's primarily spot-driven. It looks like a spot-driven market. Following the FTX event, we had all-time highs in investors taking coins off exchanges and putting them into their wallets. Part of this is going to be, shit, I just saw FTX blow up. What if my exchange is next? Part of it is 16K, thank you very much. So there's a bit of a combination of reasons why people are actually pulling coins off exchanges. But so far, to me, a lot of what this looks like is a fairly delevered market. There's a lot more open interest going on in the options space. But when you actually look at the spread of those, most of those are like long-dated call options betting on Balaji's 1 million BTC, right? So the nice thing about options is that it's essentially a defined risk. People can buy a $50,000 call. They know exactly how much they've bet. The market maker is essentially going to be neutral or delta neutral. So at the main point, you've kind of got a very delevered market. Futures are playing a much smaller role right now. It will grow, but not yet. So my big takeaway is that the dog is kind of in charge and the tail is kind of secondary at this point in time.
It's risky, I think, to claim one state of things is more natural than another, because ultimately these are just markets. They're collections of actors who, you know, express their interests and desires and predictions and, you know, in their behavior. However, there's a sense among many Bitcoiners, and I think the larger crypto community as well, that there is something more natural and healthy about the markets post the collapse of a lot of these trading venues. What's your take on that? I mean, certainly what you just described, I think a lot of people would hear and say that kind of seems healthier than what might have been there before. But again, coming from the on-chain perspective, how do you think about that?
No, I fully agree. And that's actually why we created that report, which is looking at that previous chart, which we called the shrimp supply sink. Because interestingly, the shrimps have been one of the largest accumulators. There's a lot of TradFi folks who will say, oh, but look, you know, Michael Saylor's got 140,000 coins and look how centralized these things are. Those whale volumes that are depleting contains those. And GBTC, for example, would sit in there because it's, you know, whatever it is, 650,000 Bitcoin. But that's owned by many, many people. And likewise with exchange balances. I think Willy Woo touches on this a lot. You know, those exchange balances have millions of customers who hold those. It's kind of like a claim on them. So what we're really looking at is a back to grassroots, back to retail, back to a delevered, healthier market, right? When we actually look at another key insight, I'll have to dig up the chart, but when we look at the amount of transaction volume on Bitcoin, we're doing a lot of research at the moment on the FTX and Alameda entities. And when you look at the transaction volume pretty much through the entirety of 2022, if you don't filter it, So we have a set of data we call entity adjusted. That's kind of removing entities that are churning the same volume amongst themselves. And then you look at raw volume, which is unfiltered, just as it comes out of the blockchain. The raw was extraordinarily high. The amount of transaction volume going on didn't follow a typical bearish trend, which is that you see transaction volume decline with price, right? Fewer people in the market, less liquidity, less people care. It somehow remained elevated until FTX blew up. And the more that we look at that, it was actually a stack of wash trading, a stack of malfeasant behavior by Alameda and FTX moving these enormous sums of customer Bitcoin around. And the second that they blew up, that all stopped. Transaction volume fell off a cliff, and now we're back to a much, much healthier and more realistic market. So in many ways, I've been quoted many times of saying this, I believe the Bitcoin bear market started in May 2021 on that first sell-off. When we had that, the Coinbase direct listing in April, we then had a 50% deleveraging, a huge amount of futures liquidations, a good example of when the tail wagged the dog. Massive, massive deleveraging, huge futures liquidations. And when you look at pretty much any metric, on-chain activity, cratered. The amount of transaction volume, cratered. Adoption, down. Everything entered bear market territory, almost identical to 2017 as we came off the top. And we never recovered. Even on that rally back in October and November, when we hit the actual all-time high, I still measure the Bitcoin bear market as starting in May 2021, and that April all-time high is the true all-time high, because all the activity that was going on in that second rally was essentially what I would classify as a scam pump. It just didn't have the follow-through. It didn't have the energy. And really, it was essentially it was an all-time high in bear market territory, which is kind of a wild concept, but across pretty much any metric you look at, I'm yet to find many that say otherwise. So in that regard, it's a much, much healthier market. It's a delevered market. We've flushed out many of the bad actors. And I think Nick Carter does a good job of saying, we can't truly recover until a lot of these guys go behind bars. And there's starting to be movements on that front. So I think it's a healthy perspective from a narrative sense, from market structure, and it reflects in the on-chain as well.
Well, listen, I could go all night on this. I have a bunch of other questions. One that I want to save for a future discussion that came up a couple times is how ordinals impact the data and whether they screw up data. But I think we should save that for now. Awesome conversation. I hope we can do this regularly on this show. I think, I'll get feedback, but I think people are going to find it really, really valuable. So thank you for all your work on this stuff and all the reports you guys put out, but also for hanging out today.
Thank you, Matt. It's a pleasure. Look forward to the next one.
Hey guys, back to NLW here for just the quickest of wrap-ups. I think what's clear when you listen to someone like James talk is that Bitcoin on-chain data is both a gift of the system and a superpower to understand it. It gives voice to behavior in a way that is just so profound and unique. I said on Twitter that it's in some ways like a survey that can't ask the wrong questions and that people can't answer anyway but truthfully. On-chain data is the record of what people are actually doing on-chain in the Bitcoin ecosystem, and in that way has so much to tell us. If you enjoyed this segment, please do let me know. It's something that I think would be valuable to do regularly, but I want to hear from you. Thanks, as always, for listening, and until next time, let's build.